From Brennan to the Boca Chiel, from Lummi to La Push, and from the lordly Sawduck to lovely Duckabush. From Samish to Sammamish, Suquamish to Quilicene, the climate is so friendly, it's a land that's evergreen.
Hello, and welcome to the History of the Evergreen State podcast. I'm your host, John C., and thank you for joining me today for episode 128, A History of A-Town. The Stillaguamish River Forks saw the beginning of Arlington in 1890, although this was far from being the area's first human settlement. The Coast Salish people used to go up and down the river following the plentiful fish runs, stopping to spend the night or a few days at the forks. The temporary camps, which were made of mat shelters, were commonplace in the Stillaguamish tribal area. The area was known as Skabalco by the Stillaguamish. Most likely, an important location was Chukkulchee, a significant settlement located farther up the river near today's Trafton. Moreover, travelers from the Swak, Duwamish, and other tribal groups made frequent pit stops there. As a prospector paddled up the river in a canoe with native guides in 1851, European settlers began to explore the region that would become Arlington. The Stillaguamish was crossed by an army path cut by the U.S. Army in 1856 from what is now Snohomish to just below the forks. The region was densely wooded, which would greatly hinder the growth of any communities that people were attempting to establish. But ultimately, they did, moving up the valley in the middle of the 1880s. Pioneers from Marysville built a rocky wagon road that roughly resembled the previous trail. Others began arriving in canoes. Nels T. Vett and N.C. Johnson traveled to the Stillaguamish River's forks in May of 1888 with the intention of opening the first store there. Now keep in mind, at this time there was only a couple of people in the area who had set up a tent nearby and were living communally. The Scandinavian immigrants soon began their operations in a small hut until the store was finished. Vett was born in Norway in 1854 and attended local schools up until the age of 16 before heading out to sea. He moved to Minnesota's Red River Valley in 1873 and homesteaded there for 5 years. He worked as a clerk at Battle Lake, assisting his brother in managing their general store. 2 years after being married to another Norwegian named Gurine Ellefsen, the pair moved to Stanwood, Washington Territory. Vett and fellow Battle Lake emigrant Niels C. Johnson, a Swede, formed a partnership when they both became determined to settle in the valley of the Stillaguamish. They established their business in Norman, a little community beside the Stillaguamish River. Vett soon took over as the area's postmaster. Yet, there was not enough business to support the two families. The men established their second shop near the forks, where the north and south forks of the Stillaguamish met. After spotting the expansion potential from the anticipated railroad to the northeastern section of the county, Vett intended to remain in Norman. Elise, Johnson's new wife, and he would run the new shop in Arlington. Vett traveled to Seattle in the early spring of 1888 to buy supplies for their new business. It was placed onto the small steamer Gleaner and taken upriver to the designated location. The Johnsons were also on board the Gleaner for the trip. In a little cabin, the shop started doing business in May of 1888. It was surrounded by bleak, hardly cleared ground. From the river, a muddy road led to its entrance. One of the three Indian families residing nearby may have been among its initial clients. As soon as the store structure was completed, business surged and ideas for a community were also developed. The region was soon platted and given the name Haller City in 1890. Vett relocated to Haller City and sold the Norman store to Johnson in that year. Early in the 1890s, the Vett and Johnson General Store, still going by that name by the way, was expanding. The White House Hotel joined the small store at the Forks about 4 months later in the late summer of 1888. Lee Rogers and Al Dinsmore, the hotel's proprietors, were loggers who chopped wood beside the river to the west. The two-story hotel, which boasted of its steam heat, spa, and European layout, presumably an early sort of continental breakfast, offered logging workers lodging and food. A.L. Blair led a crew that carved out a rocky route from Sylvania to the town during the summer of 1889. George Morris Haller, a rich real estate entrepreneur and the son of Colonel Granville O. Haller, saw significant potential for a settlement there, which increased interest in the Forks site. His premature death did not stop the growth of his envisioned community. As I've mentioned previously on the show, G. Morris Haller decided to take a duck hunting trip up to Whidbey Island in December of 1889 with his friend Thomas T. Miner and Miner's 22-year-old brother-in-law Lewis Cox. All three would never return, perishing in an accident on Puget Sound. George Haller's brother, Theodore, together with other interested parties, submitted the town's plat on the 24th of April 1890, designating it Haller City. Nevertheless, a different group of business people founded a city a month earlier. Located just a half mile to the east, they laid out a new town and quickly started selling properties there. It would eventually become known as Arlington. The anticipated advent of the railroad was one of the factors urging growth upriver. Arlington was J.W. McLeod's pet project, according to the Seattle Lakeshore and Eastern Contractor. Some believed he had inside knowledge because the location of the depot was crucial to the existence of both towns. A small sawmill and an additional hotel were built as Haller City expanded throughout the summer of 1890. The Stillaguamish Times relocated, leaving Stanwood and taking up residence in a pioneer's cabin at the Forks. Arlington soon responded with a bit of a construction boom. The competition for the railroad soon became quite intense. Arlington had a clear edge when the first construction materials arrived in June of 1890. Due to its location down by the riverbank, Haller City was an inappropriate place for a depot. The depot would be erected at Arlington because of its elevated location and convenient access. Lots began to sell rather quickly around the growing settlement. 9 blocks made up the initial plat, and the streets were given names of people who worked in the construction division of the Seattle, Lakeshore, and Eastern Railroad. On the 23rd of July, Arlington's first freight train arrived, which encouraged even further expansion. Before erecting a store structure in August of 1890, J.W. McLeod first sold meals from a tent. The second establishment was a bar, with Thomas Moran, a former railroad construction superintendent, joining the enterprise soon after. Arlington quickly had a post office, a warehouse, and an express office before the end of the year. In 1891, Moran would inaugurate the Arlington Hotel. The community had about 3 miles of graded roadways by that point in time. For numerous years, the two towns' rivalry persisted. Both towns were mentioned in the Gazetteer and Business Directory of 1892. A blacksmith, hay dealers, shoemakers, a stage line, meat store, livery stables, a hotel, and veterinarian were all visible in Haller City, but the telegraph and express were operational only in Arlington. There were 400 people living in the town, which also possessed a weekly newspaper, a sawmill, and a shingle mill. The directory claimed that these two settlements are expanding together, yet each town continued to expand on its own, gaining churches, social clubs, and the ever-important shingle mills. Arlington also provided a massive 200-foot-tall tree for the Chicago World's Fair in 1893. There was quite a lot of local pride generated by the highest flagstaff at the exposition that year. In 1893, things started to shift just a bit. The genuine trajectory of development may have been indicated by the clearance of a field for a ballpark. The Twin Cities Baseball Club had young men from both communities, and they played regular games, doing their part to keep the people of the settlements entertained. C.C. Brown, a businessman from Haller City, then moved his general store to Arlington in 1894. Haller City lost its post office later that same year, which led to unease even after it was fixed. Businessmen in Haller City acknowledged that it would be preferable to be in Arlington in 1895. The general store owned by Vett and Johnson was finally transported by ox team to a property on 4th Street. Others quickly adopted. The only things standing in Haller City by this point in time were the homes and the shingle mills. The two towns were combined into one and given the name Arlington in 1903. The vote for incorporation took place on the 5th of May 1903, and those in favor numbered 134, while those against numbered only 34. Arlington now had a mayor named J.M. Smith, 4 council members, a clerk, an attorney, and a treasurer. Arlington was developing rather nicely after that. It was a significant agricultural and logging hub, and it had a cooperative creamery that was first established in 1901. Farming dairy cattle has always been a risky endeavor in Snohomish County. Dairy producers lost their markets during the Panic of 1893, which caused several companies to collapse in Snohomish County. The Arlington Cooperative Association would be established in 1901 by the local dairymen with a $2,000 initial investment. J.C. Schloeman served as vice president under August Lamars' first term as president. Its main objective was to give dairy farmers a market. It provided its members with more than 10 cents over the going rate for butterfat while also producing Arlington Flawless butter and selling buttermilk. Before the start of the First World War, cream would be collected from dairy farms as far afield as Oso and Sylvana on alternate days by horse-drawn carts. Given the state of the roads, some of the cream undoubtedly arrived partially churned. The Arlington Cooperative Association eventually attracted 300 members. It produced 1,200 pounds of butter per day by the 1920s. They built a condensery in 1921 and began trucking milk there. A space for cold storage was also significantly increased. A.F. West, who had previously served as the Arlington Cooperative's treasurer, was appointed general manager of the facility in 1924. Critical sales declines for dairy farmers continued to persist. Several processors went out of business following the First World War, leaving milk without markets, and it led to the dumping of perfectly good milk on the ground since they couldn't do anything else with it. The Snohomish Dairymen's Association was established by dairymen in 1917 to aid in the growth and marketing of dairy products. It took on the Arlington Cooperative Association and two other Snohomish facilities, but it sorely needed a market outlet. Dairy Gold was established in 1925 after bringing together a number of local dairy groups. The Arlington Cooperative Association manufactured canned milk for that brand for quite a long time. The plant's operation ended in the 1950s. Fluid milk was delivered to the Seattle market by bulk tank trucks, and the market for evaporated milk, well, it evaporated. The factory was later sold by the cooperative. Arlington of the early 1900s also was able to boast of a bank, the Arlington State Bank, and schools in addition to its general stores, hotels, and other services including shingle mills. Services made possible by new technology made living more comfortable for its residents. When local investors established the Arlington Water, Light, and Power Company in 1905 to supply power and water to the town, the Sunset Telephone Company had already been there for 4 years. Access to nearby towns and communities was made possible via a wagon bridge and a state road that headed north. To reach Darrington, the Northern Pacific Railroad built a 28-mile route and offered 3 weekly trips. Eventually, Division Street was the only thing left that suggested there had ever been 2 towns. Arlington saw little development throughout the first 2 decades of the 20th century. Even though there were several fires and sporadic floods, social and civic advancements continued. Citizens established a permanent library association in November of 1912. They gathered free electricity service, a library table, and gifts totaling $215. In the Jones Building, there was a lease available, which the library association was quick to take advantage of. M. Birkenmeyer, an early settler in Arlington, donated many acres of cleared ground on the southern edge of the city in 1916 for a park. It was Arlington's first park and was used for association events while also being accessible to the general public. Eventually, the city would offer its citizens access to a park that was covered with trees. Agriculture, dairy farming, and shingle mills were the cornerstones of the local economy after the First World War. Arlington had additional enterprises when the Snohomish Dairymen's Association established a condensery and cold plant in 1921. In that same year, Arlington was home to 22 mechanical shops, 37 stores, 2 banks, 7 industries, and 241 workers overall. There were 116 more men and women working as professionals and instructors. The post office delivered daily to 700 private mailboxes with the help of the postmaster, 2 clerks, and 6 carriers. Yet, the region was not immune to the impending depression. The Arlington area saw a large unemployment rate during the 1930s as a result of the closing of the mills. In 1933, the Civilian Conservation Corps established a camp close to Darrington to generate employment. Boys from Arlington between the ages of 18 and 25 joined up. Civic projects were another type of employment supplied by the Works Progress Administration, otherwise known as the WPA. Arlington's sidewalks were constructed by the WPA that year, and the high school was under construction by 1936. Making outhouses for farmers was one of the strangest jobs-creating enterprises these young men were given. The toilets were erected by men who worked for the WPA. One of the representatives that visited the farmers and persuaded them to purchase the unit in order to enhance the area's cleanliness was Jack Gardner. He observed that the outhouse had a cement floor and a cement stool in the center, an obvious upgrade from the outhouses the farmers had been using previously. The construction of the Arlington Airport was also made feasible by federal relief initiatives. With financing assistance from the Civil Works Administration, the Arlington Commercial Club leased 200 acres of forest land from M. Birkenmeyer in February of 1934. It's important to note here that the Arlington Airport was the only airport in Snohomish County to receive funding from this federal aid program. The CWA was an early relief initiative that funded the development of new airports across the country. Early in March, preparation work on a runway that would be 400 feet wide and 4,000 feet long commenced. The runway would run from the northeast to the southwest. For the project, 86 workers were employed. The runway would be around 40% complete by the end of March. Nevertheless, because the CWA was only meant to be a temporary solution, it was terminated late in March. The airport's funding was cut off and development was briefly put on hold. The Federal Emergency Relief Administration, the CWA's replacement, had been established by early May. The Washington Emergency Relief Agency, its local equivalent, approved a fresh appropriation, and work rapidly resumed. On the 13th of June, 1934, the first aircraft landed at the airport, although there were still a few hundred feet of runway on the southwest end that needed to be graded. On the 23rd of June, the runway was completely finished, and it cost roughly $14,000. Given inflation, that's about $300,000 today. But on Sunday, the 1st of July, 1934, three biplanes held an air circus at the airport, carrying between 75 and 100 passengers up into the sky for a per-ride fee of $1.50 for adults and $1 for children. This was the airport's genuine inauguration, even if it was not an official dedication ceremony. Late in the day, Tacoma resident Dick DeLong, I'm not going to make any jokes about that, staged a parachute jump to round off the day's festivities. The airport was utilized throughout the following few years by both local and passing travelers across western Washington. The Forest Service utilized the airport to transport supplies to firemen fighting fires in distant locations, and air circuses were a favorite attraction over the years there as well. The Works Progress Administration, a different New Deal initiative, authorized financing for a cross runway that would be 2,000 feet long and 400 feet wide and be built close to the southern end of the existing runway in December of 1935. Early in 1936, construction was supposed to begin, but it did not happen. After the original lease ran out in 1939, the city and Birkenmeyer renegotiated, with Birkenmeyer reducing the duration to 2 years and raising the rent to $150 annually. He also gave the city the opportunity to acquire the land, but they were unable to do so due to the financial constraints of the lingering Great Depression. The idea of employing the airport as part of a West Coast air defense scheme had been discussed as early as the spring of 1934, while work on the first runway was still ongoing. The Navy leased the airfield from the city in the fall of 1940 to augment training facilities in Seattle, which was the first step in making that a reality. As the U.S. entered the Second World War, certain modifications were finished rapidly and the pace quickened. In order to prepare the field as a base for medium-range bombers to thwart Japan's invasion of the Aleutian Islands, the Navy gave the Army permission to do so that year. By purchasing more property, the Army quadrupled the airport size to 1,162 acres. In addition, the Army constructed two asphalt runways measuring 5,000 by 150 feet, a control tower, and about 30 additional structures, including barracks. Early in 1943, the Navy regained control of the area. The airport was given the official name U.S. Naval Auxiliary Air Station Arlington, Washington, on the 26th of June, 1943, and between 2,000 to 3,000 people showed up for the dedication ceremony. The airport expanded as the war raged on, and a third runway was completed in August of 1945, shortly before the conflict came to a close. The air station swiftly stood down following the war, and in December of 1946, the city was granted a temporary use permit to run the airport for commercial and civilian aviation once again. The airport would officially be transferred to the city of Arlington in February of 1959. Drag racers from far and wide frequented the airport for a couple of years after it hosted its first drag race event there in 1953. Two runways were initially used for racing. However, in 1964, this was reduced to one runway. and racing at the airport was completely discontinued by 1969. Arlington Airport became a popular location for gliders and ultralight aircraft, plane weighing less than 254 pounds as the turn of the century drew to a close, and an ultralight runway was added to the airport in 2000. Arlington served as a classic example of a small-town American setting for many years following the Second World War. Despite the condensery closing and the creamery activities moving to Mount Vernon, logging and agriculture remained the backbone of the local economy. With I-5's completion in the spring of 1969, things started to shift. Arlington became a more well-liked bedroom community as a result of easy access from Marysville and Everett. The community then had considerable development in the 1980s as a result of homeowners looking for inexpensive homes while working in Seattle and Everett. The city's population expanded by almost 450% in 20 years. By 2010, Arlington's population had reached over 17,000, and with the latest census numbers now available, the population of the city is now over 20,000, continuing a trend of steady growth that the area has experienced since the beginning of the 2000s. During Arlington's 120th anniversary celebrations, the city applied to become a Tree City and would be approved. Arlington, with its top-notch schools, businesses, and houses, appears to have come full circle from the dense forests of long ago to a quickly expanding town with an extensive urban community forestry program with a busy future ahead of itself. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a 5-star review and don't forget to subscribe so that you never miss a new episode. Doing so really helps the show to grow and to expand to a new audience, so any help that you can give in that regard will be greatly appreciated. Sources for this episode include Indian Stories and Legends of the Stillaguamish, Squaws, and Allied Tribes by Nels Bruseth, Volumes 1 and 2 of History of Snohomish County, Washington by William Whitfield, Arlington Centennial Pictorial History, History of Skagit and Snohomish Counties of Washington, Everett and Snohomish County, A Pictorial History by Robert M. Humphrey, HistoryLink.org, Pioneer Sketches by Will Verd, An Illustrated History of Snohomish County by David Cameron, Charles LaWarne, M. Allen May, Jack O'Donnell, and Lawrence O'Donnell, The Arlington Times, The Seattle Times, and the University of Washington Libraries. Thank you for listening to Episode 128, A History of A-Town. Episode 129 will be released next week. A special thank you goes out to Al Hirsch for providing the music for the podcast. If you have any questions about the show, please contact historyoftheevergreenstatepod@gmail.com. Thank you once again for listening to another episode of the History of the Evergreen State podcast. And until next time, I'm your host, John C.
There's peace on the Skokomish, on the Queets, and on the whole. There's calm on the Nisqually, born of ageless ice and snow. A land that nature loves so much, she stays the whole year round. I trade a royal palace for a shack on Puget Sound. There's Chimicum and Stillicum, where spouts the gooey duck. The singing Stillaguamish and the swirling Skookum Chuck. And Moklips and Copalis, where the razor clams abound. A little bit of heaven is a shack on Puget Sound. A little bit of heaven is a shack on Puget Sound.